Thanks for downloading our podcast. You can find out more about Tech Tent from our webpage. Go to bbcworldservice.com/techtent. Tech Tent, your weekly status update on the technology business. I'm Rory Catlin-Jones, and this week I'm joined by Chris Fox from the BBC Online Tech Desk. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Rory.
You've partly been wielding a smartphone in the run-up to this programme because we're live-streaming part of it from our Facebook page, if you can find it. And my very special guest to guide us through all our stories this week is Ingrid London from TechCrunch Europe. She's been breaking stories on the European tech scene for many years. Welcome, Ingrid.
Hello.
Let's get a taste of what's coming up.
A lot of famous comedians, a lot of humorists, theorists of humour have written about how some words are just funnier than other words and the punchline of a joke.
More about that cat later. But first, how far along the path to the autonomous driving future are we? At the weekend, I returned from California, where I met the man who must be the most inspiring figure in tech right now, Elon Musk. He has a rocket business, SpaceX, as well as his electric car venture, Tesla. And he certainly believes the future is arriving at breakneck speed. His company's cars have changed the image of electric vehicles, albeit for those who can afford them. But Elon Musk told me about his vision of a future where electric cars, which drive themselves, are the norm for everyone.
I think all transport, with the exception of rockets, will go fully electric. I mean, I see the value of Tesla as an accelerant, as a catalyst in that transition. In order to have a substantial effect on transportation, we have to make the cars affordable. Unless there's an affordable car, we will only have a small impact on the world.
The technology industry generally suddenly seems incredibly enthusiastic about getting into the motor industry. We've obviously had Google with its self-driving car.
Right.
Do you see that continuing? And do you see Apple building a car and that maybe being a threat to you?
I would encourage more participation by whoever it is to create electric vehicles. It's quite hard to do, but I think companies like Apple will probably make a compelling electric car. It seems like the obvious thing to do.
Are you betting that that's going to happen? Have you heard anything?
Well, it's pretty hard to hide something if you hire over 1,000 engineers to do it.
So you think Apple are serious about it?
Yeah, I do. This is an open secret.
You've also been a leader in autonomous driving, in this road to the self-driving car. How far do you think that's going to go?
The two biggest revolutions in transport are electrification and autonomy, and they're both happening at about the same time. I think autonomy is extremely important, and I think in the long term, nobody will buy a car unless it is autonomous. It will be like having a manually operated elevator or something like that.
So
it's a strange anachronism.
In 10 years' time, what will I be driving? Or will I be driving at all? Will I just be pressing a button on an app? A car will drive up and take me where I want it.
You will only drive if you want to drive. It'll be like owning a car that is not self-driving in the long term will be like owning a horse. You would own it for, and you would use it for sentimental reasons, but not for daily use, really. Unlikely.
That's Elon Musk. Now, in the studio, we've a man who's been listening somewhat sceptically to that. Christian Wolmar is a transport writer and campaigner. I think keener on bicycles than cars, Christian?
Yes, I certainly cycled here this afternoon, not on a driverless bicycle.
And why are you so doubtful about that vision? He's achieved a lot that people said he wouldn't achieve over the last 5 years or so.
Well, I think there's all sorts of reasons. Let's start with two. One is, what is the, and I prefer to call them robot cars, what are robot cars trying to solve? I mean, they're not going to help with congestion. And, OK, you know, you're supposedly going to be able to sit in the back and read the Financial Times. But you can only do that if the car, and this is my second point, if the car is 100% driverless. It's no good if it's 98% or 99%, because you won't be able to relax in the back of your car reading the Financial Times. And for him to say that within 10 years, the whole park of cars, the whole fleet of cars is going to be replaced mainly by his robot cars is completely fanciful.
Now, I mean, the reason he advances for it being more sustainable is A, they'll be electric, and B, there'll be fewer people owning cars because you'll be able to
part, if you can call one up at a moment's notice, you'll have less need to have one parked outside your house.
Neither of those is really sustainable. First of all, I drove, when I was transport correspondent at The Independent, in 1994, I drove a Ford Fiesta, I think it was, in La Rochelle, completely electric, 20 years ago. Where are they on London streets? They're still not there. So that's got a long way to go. And secondly, I don't buy this idea that if it's a robot car, it will not be your car. I don't see why these have been conflated by the robot car industry. And remember, Google had been driving these cars around for 3 or 4 years in Southern California, where fortunately it doesn't rain much, it doesn't snow, and there's not much fog, which is fortunate because they can't cope with any of those things. And they've had more than their average amount of accidents, not caused by the driverless cars, but caused by people who are not used to the sort of driving that these cars do. So there's a whole range of massive issues that have to be resolved, not least technical.
Ingrid London, you followed this closely. Are you as sceptical as Christian?
No. I think that, obviously to go to the 100% fully autonomous, we may have a long way to go. But I think that even today, we've got a lot of examples of some of these things coming to play. And those have been really interesting advances. For example, there are cars already out on the market that have small, basically bits of AI in them that help you park. You still have to do some of the gas pedaling, but it's basically steering you into your place. I think that if we can see advances like that come into the cars bit by bit, that will be very interesting and is actually getting into the realm of the autonomous car.
There's no point to that. That's fine. You know, it improves your driving experience, but it's moving to nowhere near what he was talking about in terms of having autonomous cars. I mean, it's just their aids.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I drove one of his Teslas across California, and it was in autonomous mode, partly. It kept in lane, it went round corners, it kept at a certain distance from the car in front. It was even able to change lanes. But here's the key thing. My hands were always just hovering over the wheel, and I think I might have been a bit more nervous, Ingrid, than when I was in full control.
For sure. I mean, today I would not recommend people to go out and start, driving in self-driving cars and assume it's all going to go completely well. But you have to start somewhere to get to somewhere else.
Briefly, Christian, are you optimistic at all about the role of technology in cars, or do you just think things are going to be exactly the same in 10 years as they are now?
Well, I think, it's odd that we're driving around vehicles that would be almost recognisable to people who invented the motor car. They've still got four wheels, they've still got engines and so on. So they're not there. Of course, they will help us make driving easier. But I bet that, in the lifetime of my kids, which hopefully is about 50 years, there still won't be this complete park of autonomous communal cars.
Well, we'll have to go back to Mr. Musk in a few years' time and say, has your vision actually happened? Moving on, the received wisdom is that the digital revolution is making a huge difference to the wealth and well-being of people in developing countries. And we've covered stories about that in this programme. But now the World Bank, whose job it is to help fund development, is pouring cold water on that idea. In its annual World Development Report, this year called Digital Dividends, the bank says this: the lives of the majority of the world's people remain largely untouched by the digital revolution. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is the bank's Tim Kelly, one of this report's authors. Tim, hello. Good to have you with us.
Hello. Nice to be with you.
Now, why that line? Why are most people's lives still untouched, so 25 years probably into this sort of digital revolution?
I think with many new innovations, there's an initial phase of sort of utopianism, techno-utopianism in this case, believing that the internet will feed the world, it will make for free and fair elections, it'll solve all our problems. But the reality is that it hasn't done those. It has changed the lives of individuals, but it's not yet reaching enough of those individuals worldwide.
But even when people are connected, your report seems to show that the gap between the rich and the poor nations isn't closing. In fact, it seems to be widening in some ways.
Yeah, most people's experience in the developing world of using the internet is on a small screen device, which is very nice, but it's hard to run a business or to run a government from a small screen device. We don't see the same level of penetration of fixed line internet and fast broadband in most developing countries, especially not in rural areas.
We're often told, though, that this is a leapfrog technology, that in fact, you know, the rest of the world is rapidly going to mobile. You talk to people running e-commerce organisations or news organisations, they're far more focused on the mobile phone than the fixed line. Isn't there the possibility that some people in the developing world may leapfrog ahead?
That's certainly happening, and certainly you won't find many rotary dial phones in the developing world. But the problem is that there's a need to retrofit the backbone networks of many of these developing countries. They missed out on a whole stage of evolution of laying backbone networks around cities, between cities, etc. And it's that lack of backbone infrastructure which is holding back internet speeds in many developing countries.
But you also say that just connecting people isn't enough. There's got to be a whole other set of what you call sort of analog support as well. What do you mean by that?
That's right. It's the analog complements, the skills, the institutions, the regulations that underlie the digital economy, which are simply not in place in many developing countries. So the main message is that in order to see the true benefits of digital technologies, there's a lot of offline work to do as well.
Ingrid Lundener, our special guest, we're both from a sort of a techie world which is relentlessly utopian about all this. Have we been over-optimistic?
No, I mean, again, I think that, you know, the way that you have to look at these things is that there is going to have to be, it's definitely going to be a long process. It's not an overnight thing. I mean, what's sort of interesting to me is that a lot of what we have seen as developments or upcoming developments are coming from companies from outside of Africa. You've got Facebook with its Facebook Zero and Google with Project Loon for trying to solve very much things like that backbone issue that we're talking about here. So, you know, I think that these things will come. It'll be interesting to see who runs the show when they do.
Tim Kelly, just very briefly, people wouldn't give up their mobile phones in developing countries, though, would they? They feel they're making advances.
Well, I certainly wouldn't give up my mobile phone, and I'm sure many wouldn't. But it's the complementary factors that are often missing in many developing countries, and in particular, the speed of the internet service is often too slow.
Tim Kelly from the World Bank, thank you very much. This is Tech Tent on the BBC World Service. I'm Rory Catlin-Jones. Still to come, never mind humanoid robots, we meet a robotic pet cat. But first, let's have a quick look at some of the week's other tech news with Chris Fox from the BBC Online Tech Desk. Chris, I know you're being very careful how you use your work phone and email because it appears your bosses can check up on you.
Yes, this isn't a new rule, but there's been a court case in the European Court of Human Rights. A Romanian man was fired after his employers went through his messenger that he was using at work and found out that he'd been using it for personal communications, which was against company policy. He took that to the European Court of Human Rights because he said he should have a right to a private life. But the court has ruled in the company's favour. They said, no, you shouldn't be using work equipment, work accounts for personal communications during work hours. So people were a bit alarmed this week. They thought it's a new legislation that lets the people snoop on you. But it's not the case. It's always been the same rules. Yeah. But now there's been a court case.
I was going to say, let's quickly check around the table. Christian, would it surprise you that an employer was having a look at your Facebook updates?
No, I certainly wouldn't go online at a workplace and do nefarious things.
And Ingrid, I'm sure your TechCrunch bosses are incredibly enlightened, but do you ever think, oh, maybe they're looking at my messages?
Well, I have nothing to hide. I'm an open book, Rory. No, but I mean, you know, we are, TechCrunch is owned by Verizon.
Oh, right. So they know everything
about
you.
Funny little twist there.
Chris, one more story. It turns out that Netflix, the movie streaming and TV business, they've had enough of people trying to get around their rules on where you can watch a programme. Restricted by country. Tell me.
Yes, well, I think maybe not Netflix that's had enough, but perhaps the content providers. Netflix gets its subscription money regardless of what programs people are watching. But people can use virtual private networks, which is a way of getting around those geolocation locks to watch programs that aren't available. So we still have a system where some TV shows are available on the Netflix in America, but they're not available here because the broadcasters keep them separately licensed. Now Netflix has moved into more than 130 countries and they're cracking down on people using those private networks to get around the location blocks.
And Ingrid London, you've got a story for us about tech company valuations involving Foursquare. Well, we always used to check in on Foursquare. I don't think I've used it for years.
Yeah, well, you've checked out of the check-in service, I guess I would say. So basically Foursquare, once the darling of the tech world and of apps, was valued, you know, $650 million, and then possibly going creeping up and up. It's all turned pretty bad, and they yesterday announced a new $45 million cash injection investment at, I think, about a 350. They haven't disclosed publicly, but
in other words,
heard
their value is
$350 million,
so about halved.
Yeah, it's about halved, and they've got a new CEO. So the guy who started the company, who's very much the kind of poster boy of it, Dennis Crowley, is no longer the CEO. He stepped away, and he's put in another guy. The COO, Jeff Gluck, is now running the company. So
perhaps another sign. It's just one of a number of tech companies whose valuations have been in question lately. Perhaps a sign that that bubble is easing off a bit.
Yeah.
Now, last week we were at the CES Electronics Show in Las Vegas, and we kept bumping into robots. Many of them were designed to be companions or to help out at home. But could home robotics first take off in another form, our pets? Our reporter in Silicon Valley, Dave Lee, has been meeting a robotic cat.
The world's population is getting older, and studies have shown that we're also feeling lonelier. And as people head towards their elderly years, it's that loneliness, that lack of regular companionship, that worries us all. That meowing you're hearing is from a companion robot pet made by toy company Hasbro. It costs $100, and under its fluffy white fur is a series of sensors. When you stroke the cat, it reacts accordingly, meowing, moving around, even purring in a way that produces the same kind of vibrations you'd feel from a real cat.
So many folks, as they're aging, get into situations where their life situation changes.
This is Hasbro's head of business development, Ted Fisher. He's allergic to cats and therefore a great person to create an artificial alternative for those who can't or aren't allowed to look after a real animal themselves.
We don't think this is a replacement, one-to-one for a pet. What we've tried to create is this interactive, companion that is familiar and has sort of characteristics and is very, sort of lifelike.
But does it actually work? I took the cat to meet some new people.
I'm feeling cat deprived right now.
Miriam Beams is a resident at Lake Park Residential Home in Oakland, California.
Because my cat died a year ago, and for various reasons, I haven't thought I could get another one yet. And so this is, and feeling the purr is really nice.
And this is fellow resident Jim McGookin.
He feels like a real cat. I mean, I feel the movements inside. After a while, I think the novelty would wear off.
Yeah. That was an insult.
There are other companion robots out there. The most famous and most expensive is Paro, a $5,000 seal used to comfort and treat dementia patients in hospitals all over the world. Hasbro's cat is much cheaper, but no less fluffy. And you soon forget that it's battery powered.
Dave Lee reporting there. And a special hello to dedicated Tech Tent listener Miriam Beams, who you heard in that piece. And you can see that robot cat on BBC World TV's Click this weekend. Ingrid London, that's a bit of fun. But in general, I'm a bit sceptical, strangely sceptical for me, about the advance of domestic robots. Robots doing fantastic things in factories and various places. Do we really want them in our homes yet?
Well, I think that the kind of vision, the sci-fi movie vision of this kind of all-seeing, all-knowing, all-doing robot is probably not going to happen anytime soon. But what I think that's really cool about this kitty cat robot is that it kind of highlights for me how I think robots are going to enter our life, which is in very specific purposes. The Roomba, the vacuum cleaner.
Oh, yeah.
Technically, that's a robot.
Technically,
we already have robots. A lot of people already have robots in their house. They're there to vacuum your floor. They're not there to kind of keep you company or whatever. But anyway.
Yeah. I mean, there are functional robots doing functional things.
Yeah.
Vacuum cleaners. But the big thing in Japan seems to be companions, things that will live with you. In Las Vegas, I had a robot give me a hug.
How did it feel?
It felt great, but I wasn't sure that
it was
more
than a toy. Did it warm up when you hugged it? Was it programmed to get warmer so you wasn't like hugging a hunk of metal?
It felt warm enough to me. But seriously, the point I'm trying to work out is that the beginning of something? Lots of money being poured into it, but briefly, is that the beginning of something really important?
You know, I'm a bit of a nerd when it comes to tech, obviously. And I'm very optimistic that we're going to see more and more things. I mean, I'm really surprised by, you're referring to Pepper, I think, that the SoftBank robot, which was incredible. And, you know, and I think that that's getting more and more intelligent. And I think that, yeah, we can see more of that.
An optimistic view from Ingrid. Now, one last thing before we go. Wikipedia is 15 years old today. Its mission was to create an online encyclopedia for everyone on the planet, one in which its users create and edit the content, a crowdsourcing of the world's knowledge, if you like. I ran into its founder, Jimmy Wales, yesterday, and I asked him what his favourite entry has been during the past 15 years.
One of my favourites is called Inherently Funny Words. It was actually pretty rubbish for a long time. People would just come by and stick in word they thought sounded funny. And then it was nominated for deletion, and there was a discussion of should we delete this or not. And then somebody pointed out, no, actually, a lot of famous comedians, a lot of humorists, theorists of humor have written about how some words are just funnier than other words. And the punchline of a joke, words that end in G or yogurt and badger. It's not working on you, Rory, but they're supposed to be funny words. Anyway, it's a fascinating entry now because it's about the craft of humor and the theory behind it and all that. And I just think that's great.
Now, you're someone who follows technology trends pretty closely. In the 15 years that this has been going, how has the world changed and how has that been reflected in Wikipedia?
The biggest change in technology that's happened in the last 15 years has been the rise of the smartphone. So the way we use the internet is not just on our desktop, not just on our laptop, but it's, you know, on the go all the time. That's obviously had a huge impact on us in the developed world, but it's really now beginning to have an enormous impact in the developing world. And the next billion will come online, by and large, on mobile devices, which is a great opportunity for us, but also a great challenge. We don't believe people are likely to do a huge amount of editing from a small mobile phone. But what we see is that the people in those societies who do have computers become much more motivated to write because they can see, oh, actually, my writing will do a lot of good. All these people now have phones and they'll read it, and that's quite motivating. So you can't underestimate the impact that mobile is having on virtually everything.
That's the Wikipedia founder, Jimmy Wales. And that's about all we've got time for. Thanks to my guests, Ingrid London and Christian Wolmar. Thanks to Chris Fox from the BBC Online Tech Desk. Read his work at bbc.com/technology. Keep in touch with us via Twitter and via our BBC Technology and Tech Tent Facebook page, where you can actually see a live video stream of this programme. Click on it and see how we did. And don't forget to join us again in the Tech Tent at the same time next week.